Once read a newspaper story about a doctor, a cancer specialist who had quit after 23 years working in Victoria's public hospital system. The paper said that Dr. Vaughan was the sort of doctor that the system needs. Even after treating more than 7,000 public patients, it was obvious he still cared. Listen to some of his words. Sometimes caring means sitting at the side of a dying patient for 20 minutes, not talking, not doing, just being a presence. This was a doctor who still wanted to listen to patients and understand their needs rather than just shove them through. But, he said, the changes in the public health system were mitigating against that. Caring seemed to have disappeared in a system that rewards those who shove patients through the fastest. And over the past few years, Dr. Vaughan had seen his colleagues working harder and harder, squeezing patients through the system. He had seen budget cuts erode the quality of care, and he believed that they had forced hospitals into dodgy accounting and cooking the books to make patient throughfare figures look more impressive. He had seen enough. He'd had enough. The system had no place for a doctor who sits at a bedside for 20 minutes without doing anything you can bulk bill for. And he wasn't willing to treat patients as ledger entries. So he quit. Amidst all the stories of doctors and lawyers and various other accountants and so on, various professionals rorting the system and milking it for all it's worth, it's always nice to come across someone of integrity for whom people do not have dollar values. But it's tragic when one like him feels the need to walk away because there's no place for him. No place for a person who values people over profits. The context is entirely different, but the same values question is under examination in the gospel reading that we heard tonight. A man in the crowd comes to Jesus and says, "Rabbi, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." I don't know how many of you have ever been involved in a dispute over the dividing up of a deceased parent's estate, but such disputes are never pretty. In our culture, if all else fails, the executor can always just sell up everything and divide up the proceeds equally, and usually the lawyers are the biggest winners out of such an arrangement. But in Israel, at the time of our story, the selling up option was not on. You see, the family inheritance usually consisted mostly of land, the family farm. And since the Hebrews' sense of connection to their land was somewhat similar to that of our Aboriginal people here in Australia, you can't just sell it off. Your father has left you a little bit of the holy land itself. You can't just turn it into cash. And it's usually not just dividing up a suburban block for a couple of townhouses either. Even today, it's quite difficult to work out a fair division of a farm. What if one half has a creek running through it and the other half doesn't? There are all those kind of things. Now, this fellow who approached Jesus may have been entirely justified in his view of how the property should be divided. It might well have been his brother who was holding out unreasonably. Well, in those days, the practice was that if you couldn't settle a dispute over a will, then the first one of you who could get a recognised rabbi to agree with your proposed division of the property won. The other person was legally bound to accept the rabbi's ruling. And of course, the downside of this practice was that while it sped up the dispute resolution process, it also allowed the odd rabbi a speedy way to pay off the mortgage on the beach house at Joppa. Now, one reason that I suspect that this particular fellow was not trying to rip off his brother was that if he had been, he made a very poor choice of rabbi. So it's entirely likely that this bloke had a very reasonable claim and that his brother was being obstinate and selfish. But Jesus doesn't just step in, look over the details and make a ruling, does he? As we see so many times in the stories of Jesus, when there's an attempt to drag him into a conflict on one side or the other, Jesus not only refuses to be drawn in, but he responds in a way that challenges everybody involved to step back and look at the whole thing from another angle so that a way of reconciliation might be found. Because one thing is sure in this. If this bloke got a rabbi to resolve the thing, there would be no reconciliation with his brother. It would have been a bit like a woman and her son I once heard about who, after 10 years of putting in $20 each to buy a lottery ticket each week, they actually won $4.2 million. But the son immediately claimed that he'd bought the ticket that week with his own money. And so the mother, who said that their relationship had previously been loving and close, sued him for her half. "Teacher, tell my son to divide the family winnings with me." Can't you hear it? The Jerusalem lottery. Once you bring in the lawyers to resolve a family dispute, you might win the dispute, but you're unlikely to still have a family by the end of it. So Jesus tells a story of a bloke who got all the goodies but no family. A rich man who was making money hand over foot beyond what even he expected. It always reminds me when I hear this story of Jesus of a factory owner that I used to work for who seemed to be able to bungle his decisions one after the other and still make money out of them. It used to drive me nuts. While I worked for him, he formed a partnership with another company to install $1 million worth of machinery in his factory. And this was back in the days when $1 million worth of machinery is quite a lot. And my boss was actually sufficiently incompetent that when he signed the agreement, he thought it only made one product, but it actually made eight. And the upshot of it was it made him eight times as much money as he expected. And he bought another new Porsche. Now, the bloke in Jesus' story has had eight times the harvest he expects, and it won't all fit in his barns, so he has to decide what to do with it. Now, the first thing that most Jews would have done in the circumstances were to give thanks to God for this great blessing and then celebrate with all their friends by throwing a party. And the usual thing to do when making a tough decision, like what to do with the excess, would have been to walk down to the town gates where the elders of the community spent their time chewing over the problems of the universe and discuss it with them. And the culture in those meetings was always against introducing a solution too quickly because there's no point in messing up a good debate by introducing a definitive answer. Community discussions were valued for their own sake. So most people in this bloke's position would have gone down there or at least chewed it over with their family. But he doesn't do any of those things. He thanks no one, and when he celebrates alone. And when he wants advice, he talks to himself. That's actually how it's described in the story. Jesus keeps saying, "And he said to himself," and he answered himself. He said to himself, "What shall I do?" And then he answered himself, "I shall do this. I will pull down my barns and build bigger barns, and there I will store all my grain and goods." Now, this was a bloke who not only had a bumper crop, but he already had so many goods that he was storing them in the barns too. And then he's still talking to himself. "And I will say to myself, self, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry." So you can imagine why this bloke got no one else to talk to. He's the sort of character who would sell his grandmother if there was a buck in her. The sort that nobody actually wants for a friend. Jesus prefaced this story by saying that your life does not consist in the abundance of your possessions. And now he's set up this almost sort of Jeffrey Edelston type picture of this pathetic character who's lived as though life was just a case of he who dies with the most toys wins. So he's saying to the man with the property division problem, "How much is it worth to win this? Will your life really be better if you destroy your family to get your hands on the inheritance?" When Jesus said that life doesn't consist in the abundance of possessions, he didn't spell out the alternative. He didn't need to. It was obvious to everyone in a culture that was still structured around extended families and community networks. In our culture, it's harder for many of us to see. We are constantly bombarded with images that tell us over and over that life consists in driving this car, in wearing this fragrance, in having this logo on the side of your shoes, in drinking this coffee. Images telling us that not only can we have it all, but we deserve it all, and that we'll be pitiful and miserable failures if we don't have it all. And we have industries devoted to shaping the conversation when we talk to ourselves, so that when we look in a shop window and think, isn't that beautiful? The following voice that says, yes, but you don't need one and you can't afford it, is quickly drowned out by all these other voices that have been well tutored in saying, you deserve it, you've earned it, you have a right to it. Even voices that say, and you're contributing to the economy by buying it. You can put it on credit. You're keeping the wheels of industry turning. You're a responsible citizen. Margie Acacia and I have just finished watching recordings of the wonderful, now quite old, TV series Sea Change. And in one episode of Sea Change, Laura, the former big city lawyer who dropped out of the rat race to become a local magistrate in a small coastal town, was being lured back to the big smoke by her former boss. And he says, come on, you've done your escape thing. You've spent some quality time with your kids. It's time to return to the real world. We'll double your salary. Back to the real world, the world where you'll sacrifice your kids for a pay rise. The world where all relationships are expendable in the pursuit of the dollar, which seems to be becoming more and more the world that we live in. In Jesus' day, to be rich was valued, but to be rich without family or close relationships was seen as a ludicrous waste and a pitiful condition. Today, we would probably elect that man Prime Minister. He'd certainly be a shoo-in for any available CEO position, and we'd probably have him restructuring our hospital system, deciding how much to spend on maintaining our water quality or something of the sort. No wonder the good doctors are walking out. We keep electing politicians who believe that treating sick patients and supplying water to major cities should be profit-making ventures. Funny how profits look better if you provide less care, isn't it? Having crippled ourselves with a consumer culture of covetousness, work, shop, accumulate, die, we're now seeing what goes on when we structure the institutions of our society on the same principles that we've been living by. We find they become as sick and friendless and dysfunctional as the people running them. An individual's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. A society's life does not consist in the profit dividends of its essential services or in keeping others out so that we can keep all the goodies to ourselves in our own little barns. Jesus points us back to what our lives do consist of: our interrelatedness to God, with one another, and with our world. The web of connections, which you can and do take with you. Any values or priorities for which you are willing to sacrifice those interconnections, those relationships, are values and priorities that will cripple you and drain you of spirit and life itself. Jesus said, I've come that you might have life and have it abundantly. Barn fulls of it. Jesus came to reconnect you with the sources of life, with love, with hope, with care, with joy, with the very God of life. At this table, God places the bread of life and the lifeblood of the universe into our hands and says, eat, drink, this is my body given for you, that you might have life. At this table, Jesus invites us into relationship with God and with everyone who gathers at this table. The choice is yours. At which table will you find the life that you want? If you're busy having a conversation with yourself about where you'll store all the things you really want when your cards come up on the blackjack table, then you'll probably find nothing of recognisable value at this table, and you'll walk on by. But if you're sick of living like an island, working like a robot, and being treated like a ledger entry, then at this table you'll find the way out. Ordinary things of no monetary worth, but priceless if you're looking for the way back into connection with the spirit of the universe and with those who are travelling into the fullness of life.